You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Many of us recycle diligently, buy local produce, bring reusable bags to the supermarket, eat sustainable seafood, and do whatever else we can to reduce our carbon footprints. But even though those practices are good for the environment, they don't really add up to much. Gernot Wagner, an economist at the Environmental Defense Fund, who also teaches at Columbia, argues that only economic policies can make a difference in reducing greenhouse gases and the other pollutants that cause climate change. His new book on the matter, But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World, is published by Hill and Wang, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Now, people may not have heard of the field of environmental economics. Can you describe economics as a way of thinking? I mean, what is going on here? If you are you just seeing the world through the filter of economics? If you were a physicist, wouldn't you see the solution to all of these problems in terms of that specialty?
Kind of, right? So, I mean, economics in the sense is it is common sense, right? It's sort of organized common sense, I guess, is the best way of putting it. So applying the economic lens to environmental problems is just looking at these very basic principles that drive all of us, that define us as a society, and trying to apply that to environmental problems.
Well, one person eating less meat or deciding to get a Prius instead of an SUV or bringing reusable bags to the grocery store might not make a difference. But if everyone did it, wouldn't that make a difference?
Kind of, right? So the problem there is, so I mean, I do all these things too. I don't eat meat. I don't have a driver's license, right? So I try to do all the right things. Now, you need to scale that up, right? And the question basically is, how do you do that, right? How do you get a billion people to recycle? That's the first question, right? And then, and this is sort of the key point here, is even if a billion people recycle, would it make a difference? And the surprising answer in many ways is no, not even that would be enough.
And then it's impossible to avoid certain things like flying in airplanes, or if we want orange juice, they've got to be trucked up from Florida or California.
For example, right? So if you try to do all the right things, I mean, you're going positively crazy, right? I mean, that's the real issue, right? You stand at Whole Foods, right, trying to decide between buying the local apple that spent 6 months in a cool house in upstate New York versus buying the organic apple that was just flown in from South Africa in season there versus not eating an apple at all and foregoing the vitamins and, right, sort of running the danger of getting sick, right? So if you're trying to balance all these things, and you simply can't, right? We don't have the information to make that decision on the spot.
In your book, you write about wrong incentives. What are they?
So in this case, right, the cost of flying that apple in, or the cost of storing that apple in the cool house, the pollution cost of that is not incorporated in the price of that apple, right? So the local apple is artificially cheap because it does not include the price of the pollution, mm-hmm, that cooling it over 6 months costs. The price of the apple flown in from overseas is artificially cheap because it doesn't include the price of the pollution that the flight causes. All right, so you don't face the right incentives when you stand there and try to decide which of these apples to pick.
Well, it sounds to me darned if you do, darned if you don't. Is there a better solution? I mean, you're saying economics is the best solution, but that's, in other words, you're saying we just have to ignore making these choices?
What we should strive for is that the price of that apple does, in fact, reflect the full cost of pollution. And this is where the economics comes in, right? This is where we now say, okay, so let's put a dollar value on that cost of pollution and add that to the price of the apple, right? And now you're faced with the right decision. Now you can say, well, you know, let me buy the cheapest apple, the cheapest organic apple, if you will. And now you make the trade-off between the one flown in from South Africa, the one cooled in a cool house in upstate New York, and you make it based on the information you can actually identify and sort of easily look at, and that's the price.
One of the downsides of capitalism is that risk takers make all the gains, but society at large often suffers the losses, as we've seen in the financial crisis that has done much to damage the whole economy, but hasn't really hurt investment bankers and traders. How does this aspect of capitalism apply to what we're talking about, the environment?
I mean, not to split hairs here, but it would be great if we actually had capitalism, if the capitalists actually owned their own machinery, right? If capital belonged to the ones making the decision, right? One of the problems in the financial sector is that it's gambling with other people's money. So you don't actually face your consequences. And in a way, right, so sort of to go to political extremes here, we socialize those costs, right? It's sort of planetary socialism, if you will, where you don't have a real market economy where everyone faces the private benefits and the private costs of your decision as well.
But don't many economists argue that all of these things resolve themselves through a free market economy?
Well, they would if everyone faced the right incentives, right? If you face the full cost of your decision, right? Going back to plane travel, if you face the full cost of your decision, including the pollution cost of your flight, then absolutely, right? Yes, that's the point.
But you also point out that we don't really have a free market economy. We talk about it, but we don't really live within it.
Exactly, right? So in that sense, we live in a society where we do have those private benefits, right? Me hopping on a plane flying across the Atlantic, I get the benefit, right? Everybody else, all 7 billion of us, are faced with the cost of my decision to fly.
My guest is Gernot Wagner, whose book, But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World, is published by Hill and Wang. The kind of change that you're advocating, putting a price on carbon and requiring polluters to pay, isn't going to come about voluntarily with business saying, okay, we want to do this. So how can it be promoted and actually take effect in this country?
Well, it turns out that on one level, right, the ones who are most affected by this, of course, are not going to stand up and volunteer and say, yes, please let me pay more, right? This is up to society, up to politics then to make the decision and say, look, we ought to be leveling the playing field here. We can't keep on subsidizing both explicitly and implicitly fossil fuel and pollution and essentially have everyone else pay for the consequences.
So you're really advocating cap and trade. And isn't cap and trade a dirty word among pro-business conservatives? They say it isn't the best regulation to lower greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, it's a dirty word by now, yes, sure, right? But, well, turns out before Mitt Romney or Newt Gingrich, for example, were running for president, they were very much for emissions trading, for putting a limit on pollution. Mitt Romney in Massachusetts, right, signed up the state to that. And Newt Gingrich, standing next to Nancy Pelosi, was advocating for exactly that system as the most business-friendly way of trying to limit pollution and the most flexible way then of achieving that limit.
So what's happened? Had they just caved into the pressure from the business community, or have they seeing the error of their ways?
Well, it's certainly the former, right? So, and it's not actually so much caving into the pressure of the business community so much as caving into pressures of certain elements in the conservative movement that basically consider not just cap and trade but global warming a dirty word.
And any kind of regulation dirty as well.
Exactly.
Where has cap and trade been successful?
I need to pull out my second passport, my original one, I guess, and look to Europe. The emissions trading system that the European Union has put in place is not the perfect system yet, quite yet, but it has been extremely successful in focusing our attention on what really matters here.
But has it really been cutting down on pollution in Europe?
It has, yes, absolutely. It's been in effect now for real since 2008. And every one of these years has contributed to a substantial portion of the overall emissions reductions.
Well, people call cap and trade a form of taxation, isn't it?
It's much, much more than that. It is limiting pollution, leveling the playing field, and yes, part of that is, and you know, I don't want to split hairs here, part of that is to increase the price of fossil fuel. Essentially decrease the subsidies that fossil fuel has right now and make sure that you and I as individuals are paying the true cost of our action.
Have we used a form of cap and trade in the past in this country, for example, to reduce acid rain and to get lead out of gasoline?
We have, and both of those are pretty good examples, and they were extremely, extremely successful. The Economist, the magazine, called the SO2 sulfur dioxide cap and trade story the most successful environmental story of the last decade.
So why aren't advocates of cap and trade pointing to that as a success story?
Oh, believe me, we are. Right? I mean, that's that is part of the effort, of course, right? Pointing to that, and of course, pointing to extremely successful examples in other areas where the exact same principle applies and works very, very well.
Such as?
Such as the emissions trading system in Europe is one example. And the same principle you can apply to a host of other problems where really the goal is to create a market where there wasn't one before, create pollution or property rights over things we care about or in terms of pollution I'd want to get rid of where there haven't been any before. And that is, in fact, as an economist, right, we would argue, the only way of going about, the best way, the most efficient, the most cost-effective way of going about solving this problem.
Well, critics of the president accuse him of trying to make America more European. And right now, we read in the paper about all the problems in the Eurozone, so perhaps that makes Americans less receptive to hearing that Europeans are doing well with something like this.
Well, Europeans are doing well with this, and they're doing well with that, applying a very, very American solution. Right? The European cap and trade system was put in place after the U.S. had put its own cap and trade systems in place and essentially was very, very reluctant initially. The Europeans had a different approach. They had sort of the top-down command and control, sort of Euro-style approach, if you will. It was the Americans who put cap and trade on the picture, and now Europeans have adopted it and are doing very well with it.
They wanted to try a more regulatory approach. But regulation is another topic that triggers political fights in this country. Republicans see it as a job killer, strangling the free market, and most Democrats support it, but not enough to get legislation passed. So how can economists step in here and advocate for better regulations without creating a partisan fight?
Well, to create better regulation in this case means, in many ways, creating flexible regulation, creating the kind of regulation that businesses can get behind and, in fact, do get behind. Right? Emissions trading isn't just about leveling the playing field and making polluters pay. That's, of course, one component, and we shouldn't be shy about saying that out loud, but it is also about creating market opportunities, creating opportunities for those who are more efficient, who are more energy efficient, to actually make money.
Because polluters could pay and still make a lot of money and just say, well, that's the cost of doing business.
Up to a point, yes, right? And of course, there's many, many others who would line up and say, hey, this is a way for me to truly make money here, right? It's, in the end, it's not a secret that we are running out of atmosphere before we will run out of oil and coal. Right?
And that's something we'll address when we come back. My guest is Gernot Wagner, an economist at the Environmental Defense Fund. He teaches at Columbia, and he's written a book called But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World is published by Hill and Wang. My guest is Gernot Wagner. His book, But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World, it's published by Hill and Wang. A listener asks, who should bear the cost of putting a price on the carbon footprint of something like an apple, the producer or the consumer? Because in the end, it winds up being put on the consumer, isn't it?
It is, right? And sort of going through the steps here, sort of the common sense economics, right? You would say, well, if you pass the cost down to the consumer, right, fewer consumers will be buying your energy-intensive product, will switch to the less energy-intensive one. So it is now absolutely in your interest to be making your own products less energy-intensive, less pollution-intensive, to make them cheaper.
The other argument is if we start applying all sorts of rules, then the producers will move elsewhere and we'll just switch the pollution from the United States to Mexico or China or India or some other country.
Well, I wished we were in a situation where we would even have to think about this. Now, there's two responses to this. One, it's not a true problem that really affects regulation here in the sense that this is what businesses think about when they move. Well, I mean, newsflash, businesses are already moving to China. Right, but if anything, right now we are facing some of the reverse here, where India has a coal tax, China is looking at cap and trade and carbon taxes, Mexico is looking into experimenting with cap and trade and looking at some of these solutions, and we in the U.S. are not.
Let's look at some of the numbers. You point out that before 1750, concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere were 280 parts per million. What is it now?
Now we have passed the 350 mark, which many environmentalists will tell you is probably the crucial one to stabilize the global climate. So yes, in many ways, we've locked in centuries of warming and rising sea levels simply by what we've done so far, right? So even if we did the right things tomorrow, we would still have locked in some of the problem already.
Critics take two different approaches. Some say that we are seeing some form of climate change, but it's not a man-made. And others are saying that it's all just bad science. Has it been proven that higher concentrations of carbon dioxide result in higher temperatures?
Well, here's the first question I would ask if you either asked that question or sort of stated it outright, which is your mic on? Right? Can you please say that on the record? First of all, chance is pretty good it would disqualify you from public office, hopefully, right, in 10, 20 years from now. And more importantly, your children may want to know that that you say that. But, I mean, seriously, right, so there are basically two responses to this. One is to say, look, it doesn't matter, right? Forget about pollution. Most of the things that we say we need to be doing to stabilize the climate, to stop global warming, we should be doing anyways, right? The opposite of energy efficiency is energy waste. It's clearly not a good idea. We need to modernize the electricity grid anyways, right? It doesn't matter whether you care about pollution or not. So that's one response, right? And the second one, of course, is, yes, I mean, you can talk about the uncertainty in the science here, but the uncertainty itself actually prompts us to act now, to keep our options open, to act sooner, not to just sit there and wait.
In this book, you write about Martin Weitzman, an economist at Harvard. How did he switch his theories from the stock market to climate change?
This is, I guess, black swans is the best example here to look at, right? So these extreme events. In the book, I talk about 10-foot women. It's the kinds of things, of course, these mythical creatures that unless you see them, you would never believe that they exist. And of course, in reality, they don't exist. Well, it turns out in the stock market, these creatures, these 10-foot women, the black swans, the unknown unknowns, drive the eventual outcome. And you can take that, convert it to the discussion on global warming, and come up with the same conclusion that these low probability, high, high impact events drive the outcome here.
I'm not sure I understand the whole matter of the 10-foot tall woman problem.
Well, so So if you stood at the party and sort of tried to make a guess who the average height of the next woman walking through the door, well, a pretty good guess would be 5'5", right? We basically, anyone taller than 8 feet, right, would be an abnormality, and 10 feet simply doesn't exist, right?
There probably are a few 7 foot tall women.
Sure, right. So the tallest one recorded in the Guinness Book of World Records, right, is between 7 and 8, right? So yes, but 10 foot women don't exist. Now, turns out in something like the stock market, we see 10 foot women with rather frequently, right? We see them all the time, and those drive the results. You can have these 1-2% gains every single day of your life if you want. What really drives the value of your portfolio eventually is the Black Friday, is the Black Tuesday, or sort of the Black Week we had in 08, right? Sort of a whole series of 10-foot women day after day after day walking in and
anomalies,
slashing.
Things
exactly, right? And that's exactly what we need to be worried about with global warming.
Economists measure and assign costs to things. Can you explain how economists assign costs to carbon emissions?
The figure you come up in the end for carbon emissions, the cost that economists come up with, is something like $20 per ton of CO2, per ton of carbon dioxide. And how you come up with is essentially you look at the consumption. Average consumption that we get without global warming. You compare that with the average consumption going forward with global warming. Well, you look at the difference and divide it by the tons of CO2, right? So it's a fairly analytical process, of course, but the number coming out at the end is very real and is, in fact, pretty scary.
And you write that a ton of coal and a barrel of oil consumption can cause more damage to human health and the economy than they add to the GDP. How is that damage measured?
That is the health impact, right? So you put a ton of coal, you burn a ton of coal. Turns out that one ton of coal produces more than one ton of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and the side effects, not just the CO2, but mercury and all the other pollutants associated with coal, do in fact cost us as society more than that one ton adds to gross domestic product, adds value to our economy.
Is it hard for regular people to understand the actual costs of global warming and other environmental damage because we can't see it or feel it? If you're in Mexico City, you actually can see it because the air turns orange by Friday after the pollution. But here, we're totally unaware of it.
People in LA
used to have the problem. LA has cleaned up its air.
It has, right? Now, it hasn't. It has cleaned up its smog and ozone and other pollutants. It hasn't cleaned up its CO2, its carbon dioxide. And that, of course, is the problem, right? CO2 is this odorless, colorless gas, right? And you and I, on average, as Americans, right, we dump 20 tons of carbon dioxide per year as individuals into the atmosphere, and, well, you don't notice that on any given day.
My guest is Gernot Wagner. His book, But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World. It's published by Hill and Wang. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Let's look at something else that a lot of people are concerned about. Plastic bags is an example of how environmental legislation works. A few cities and countries have put a tax on them. Has that worked to reduce their use?
It has, and to an amazing, amazing extent. It was actually Ireland, the country, that in 2002 put a so-called plast tax in place. Right, it was 15 euro cents, 15 cents, right, on a $100 grocery purchase, 100 euro grocery purchase. You wouldn't notice that, right? That's not the kind of thing that makes or breaks your decision on whether to get it back. Well, it turns out it has a huge impact. Plastic bag use decreased by 90%, 90, a billion bags a year. Right? And by now, Washington, D.C., for example, the city, not the federal government, the city has put in place a similar 5-cent bag fee on all disposable bags, paper and plastic. And the final data on it, yet it's only been in place for a couple of years, since 2010. But it has also made an amazing change, right? It's sort of the psychology of it all that really drives the difference.
And San Francisco has also done it, as far as I know. But then there is the whole fight over incandescent light bulbs. Michelle Bachmann, when she was still running for president, said the first thing she would do is put them in every socket in the White House. Is it good? Is it a good idea to regulate out old technology for more efficient technology?
Well, for this one, it actually turned out it was George W. Bush who signed that into law, right? And it wasn't even a ban on incandescent light bulbs, how Michelle Bachmann would like to think it was. It was a standard, an efficiency standard for a light bulb, right? Something Thomas Edison, for one, certainly would have got behind and said, well, yes, we need to drive technologies here. And in this case, we need to give consumers more choice than there would have been without that standard.
And going back further, another conservative Republican president, Richard Nixon, in 1970 signed the Environmental Policy Act. And that decade also saw the passage of the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Clean Water Act, and a bunch of other regulations. What made that time right for environmental action?
Well, this is the irony here, right? It was Richard Nixon who built the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. And back then, it was, in fact...
And Rick Perry would like to get rid of it if he could remember
if he could remember name. It. I guess so, yes. So, ironical, right? We are looking to Richard Nixon as now a sort of an example of an environmental president. That's where what we have come to.
Well, the Endangered Species Act has been effective, hasn't it? But it also has been rather controversial. People always point to some kind of tadpole that's threatened.
Endangered Species Act is actually a pretty good example of an act that has been effective and successful to protect certain species, and you know, many species, of course. But it's also an example of when an economist looks at this and says, well, actually, that's not what we can do or should do even to, for example, combat global warming. That's the wrong approach here. The Endangered Species Act, what it says is it puts certain species essentially off limit. It basically says the red-cockaded woodpecker, it's worth infinity. We need to spend as much as humanly possible to protect that one bird. That sort of all-or-nothing conservation approach simply doesn't work when we now look at something like global warming. That's where economic principles need to come to the fore.
What about what happened in Maine with lobsters, where they regulated the amount of lobsters that could be taken because of declining stocks, or in the Alaskan halibut fishing in Massachusetts, there have been limits put on fishermen. The fishermen complain, but have they had a positive effect?
Absolutely, and this is now the positive example here, right? So a lobsterman in Maine is a very good example. It was actually the lobstermen themselves who created something akin to lobster gangs, mafia style, essentially, were given that lobster don't move all that much in any given year. It's pretty easy to basically stake out your territory out in the sea, right? So you can contrast that with something like bluefin tuna, right, that swims for hundreds or thousands of miles every year. If you don't catch the tuna today, someone else will catch it tomorrow. For lobster, it's very different, right? If you don't catch it today, you will be the one who will be able to catch more next year. So in that case, given that you can put property rights over lobster out in the ocean, you, in fact, can manage your own lobster stock and go about protecting the species while also reaping profits for yourself.
California has instituted its own cap-and-trade system, which is set to begin next year. Do you think that that's the way to go, states acting on their own? And wouldn't a federal approach be more effective, or
it would be, and ultimately this is of course where we need to go. But I mean, California is a good example of an economy, or by some measures the eighth or ninth largest economy on the planet, that now is pursuing the most flexible way of going about regulating CO2 and doing it, by all accounts, very, very well.
Isn't part of the problem also that there's a lot of money in opposition to the kinds of things you're promoting during the 2008-2010 election cycle? Coal and oil companies and conservative groups that deny global warming spend 10 times more money than those advocating renewable energy and those who support climate change legislation.
They did, right? And California is a good counterexample here. In California, it was 3-1 the other way. It was clean tech who won the financial fight here, outspending dirty fuel by a factor of 3-1. So there are some hopeful signs on the horizon.
Maybe the Koch brothers just gave up on California.
Well, that was probably the wrong decision, because California now, it could very well be the shining example here on the Hill for federal action to come.
So what is your feeling? Right now, it doesn't look all that promising for cap-and-trade legislation in this country. Do you see it as inevitable?
Well, it was actually Mitt Romney, right, a conservative governor in liberal Massachusetts, who essentially pioneered national health care, right? Romney Care, 4 years later, turned into something very close, Obamacare, and now via federal health care. Hopefully, I mean, here's the hope, I guess. Maybe it's a conservative governor in liberal California, right? Schwarzenegger in California, who signed the California cap and trade law into place, who will hopefully pioneer cap and trade for the country.
Gernot Wagner's book, But Will the Planet Notice? How Smart Economics Can Save the World, is published by Hill and Wang. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.